On one hand, I'm sure that everyone here has some feelings of respect or at least tolerance for Islam, whether we know a Muslim or a few Muslims personally, or we feel empathy for the horrible treatment of American Muslims since September 11th, or we affirm the value of religious freedom generally, I feel like we could generate many positive thoughts and feelings about the Muslim people and the Islamic faith. On the other hand, I think we could probably also generate a list of concerns as a result of how our culture and our politics and our historical relationship with Islam has played out. In the last few years, I've had the opportunity to study Islam in some depth, which has included a close reading of the entire Quran and a seminary course taught by a female Muslim scholar and lawyer. Now, I went into these learning experiences expecting to enjoy and to learn a lot, but I wasn't prepared for what else would happen, which is that I became deeply, deeply moved by the life and the work of Muhammad. So much so that I'm convinced that what he set out to do and actually did in 7th century Arabia is tremendously relevant to the United States today and in many ways to Unitarian Universalism in particular. In fact, I would go so far as to say that Muhammad and Islam issue us an ethical and spiritual challenge that cuts right to the heart of who we are. And not just who we are in an abstract sense, but who we are as liberal religious people living in the United States right now. In her book, A History of God, The 4,000-Year Quest of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, author Karen Armstrong describes Muhammad as a man of, quote, exceptional genius. By the time of his death in 632, quote, he had managed to bring nearly all the tribes of Arabia into a new community, or ummah. And I think she's right. What he did was absolutely brilliant. And so here is some of his story recounted by Armstrong. The year is approximately 610. Muhammad ibn Abdullah is about 40 years old. He's married to a successful businesswoman. They're living a relatively comfortable life in Mecca. But Muhammad is discontent about what is happening in Arab society. Just two generations earlier, Arab people had been nomadic. But in recent years, Muhammad's own tribe, the Quraysh, had prospered, which turned Mecca into the most important city in all of Arabia. And in addition to being a center of religious practice, Mecca had become a center of trade and finance. Now, one of the things this did is it made the Quraysh ridiculously wealthy. And in Muhammad's view, that wealth was destroying the cooperative communal culture that used to exist among his people. In short, he thought that the Quraysh were making a new religion out of money, and he feared that it would destroy the tribe. Armstrong writes that in the old nomadic days, the tribe had to come first and the individual second. Each one of its members knew that they all depended on one another for survival. Consequently, they had a duty to take care of the poor and the vulnerable in their ethnic group. Now, however, with the rise of the Quraysh and wealth, individualism had replaced the communal ideal, and competition had become the norm. Sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? Now, in those days, religion and culture and politics were essentially inseparable. And so whatever solution Muhammad pursued would need to have a religious element to it. Eventually, he became convinced that in order to overcome the egotism and the greed, there needed to be a transcendent value at the center of people's lives. There needed to be something that unified the people and reminded them of their obligation to each other, and most especially of their obligation to the poor and the vulnerable. According to Muhammad, he was visited by an angel of God and commanded to recite. He describes the initial experience as terrifying. And years passed before his first encounter with the angel and the time he started preaching about it publicly. Now, whether or not he was actually visited by an angel of God, the end result certainly does border on the miraculous. Because a man who could neither read nor write produced some of the most beautiful poetry ever composed in the Arabic language. And within 20 years, he had united a nation. And unite is the operative word. The chapter in Armstrong's book is called Unity, the God of Islam, for a reason. And that reason is that the text of the Quran and Muhammad's life in general are focused on the theme of unity. And it's a very specific kind of unity. But before I tell you what it is, I want to tell you what it is not. It is not unity around theological doctrine or creed. Instead, as in Judaism, God is experienced in Islam as a moral imperative. In practical terms, Islam meant that Muslims had a duty to create a just and equitable society where the poor and the vulnerable are treated decently. And I just love that idea of God as a moral imperative, that's the unity that Islam is focused on. It's the unity of ethical action. The main point of worshiping God in Islam, of praying to God, is to remind Muslims to be responsible and to be grateful. And so, ever since learning of this, I've been wondering what we Unitarian Universalists can do to remind us of our ethical values and commitments. Which, of course, begs the question, how much do we really want to be reminded of our ethical values and commitments? Do we take our values that seriously? And I ask this question in all seriousness for me as well as for us. Are we willing to have regular practices that call us to accountability for acting according to our values? And if not, why not? What's going on with us that we're afraid of that level of accountability? I think it's probably that we're afraid of the change we would have to make in how we're living, how we're loving, how we're spending our time and our money. But I think it's a worthy question. What would have to change in our lives if we were to make a deep, deep commitment to living our values and a commitment to practices that remind us of those values? What would it change in our lives? What would it change in our congregation? And I have to be honest, I think that Unitarian Universalism is a transformative, spirit-growing, justice-seeking, life-affirming, world-changing religion. I do. And we have enormous potential to grow and to thrive and to make a difference in our world, but we have to take our faith and our values seriously to do that. And you and I wouldn't be here today if we didn't take our Unitarian Universalist values seriously, at least to some extent. We're here, right? With some guests, too. Welcome, guests. I'm glad to have you with us as well. But the thing is, I think our values are pretty good. There's nothing to hide. In fact, I think we should celebrate the fact that our religious values tend to be expressed as ethical obligations in the great tradition of both Judaism, Christianity to some extent, and Islam. Our values offer incredible potential for creating joy and meaning and justice for us as individuals, for us as a congregation, and for the larger world. In sum, I think our values are worth reminding ourselves of. So what would it look like? What would it look like to have a spiritual practice that reminded us that every person has inherent worth and dignity? Consider the greeting and response in Islam. Peace be unto you. Peace be unto you also. What a beautiful way to recognize each other and to recognize someone else's inherent worth and dignity. I don't know that we should copy that exactly, but I don't think it's such a bad idea either. In fact, I think we would do well to learn from Islam in many ways. Now, notably, pretty much all of the spiritual practices in Islam involve more than just words. Take the daily prayers, for example, as an embodied reminder of their obligation to God. Followers of Muhammad bow down in ritual prayer. That external physical gesture of bowing is intended to cultivate a humble internal presence. Now, the Quraysh, Muhammad's wealthy tribe, were horrified when they saw people in their proud clan bowing down as if they were slaves. And they were so stridently opposed to that practice that early Muslims had to pray in secret. They could not bow down publicly without retribution. But as Armstrong writes, the reaction of the Quraysh showed that Muhammad had diagnosed their spirit with unerring accuracy. Given how much we Unitarian Universalists tend to live in our heads, it seems to me that we could really benefit from getting our bodies involved a little bit. And I have to admit that my initial reaction to the thought of bowing down in prayer is not all that different from the Quraysh. There's something about that idea of bowing, of putting my knees on the ground and bowing, that makes me more than a little bit uncomfortable. But what I keep coming back to is maybe that's exactly the point. That the reason we need to bow down is that we need to be able to recognize some transcendent value that is greater than our own self. It may be God for you, it may not. It may be community, it may be universe. I think there are many, many ways that each of us can define that transcendent value for ourselves. But the challenge, I think, is a good one. Now, even when Muslim spiritual practices involve mostly words, it's words and music. Music was used in early Islam as it was in early Judaism because writing and literacy were rare. And so it made sense to use music because it helps people connect with it. And in fact, it helps us connect with our emotions as well in much deeper ways. That's as true today as it was 1,700 years ago or 2,000 years ago. And it's one of the reasons that so many Muslims know the Quran by heart, because it's not just recited, it's sung. I would estimate that there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people in the world today who know the entire Quran by heart, because it is their sung prayer. Now, in just a moment, I'm going to ask Brian to come forward and read a surah, or chapter, from the Quran. And in it, you'll hear a strong affirmation of economic justice, affirming the value of generosity and the consequences of being selfish. The surah presents a very clear choice between sharing wealth or hoarding it. Now, one note about the pronouns, the Quran is written in the first person, as if it's coming from God, and also it uses the royal we. So when you hear we and our in this passage, that is the voice of the singular God speaking. And after the text reading, we'll actually hear the verse recited, but I'll say a few words after it. But at this time, I'd like to invite Brian to read Surah 92 from the Quran, Al-Lail, the night.
Al-Lail. In the name of God, the Lord of mercy, the giver of mercy. By the enshrouding night, by the radiant day, by his creation of male and female, the ways you take differ greatly. There is the one who gives, who is mindful of God, who testifies to goodness. We shall smooth his way towards ease. There is the one who is miserly, who is self-satisfied, who denies goodness. We shall smooth his way towards hardships, and his wealth will not help him as he falls. Our part is to provide guidance. This world and the next belong to us. So I warn you about the raging fire, in which none but the most wicked will burn, who denied the truth and turned away. The most pious will be spared this, who gives his wealth away as self-purification, not to return a favor to anyone, but to set for the sake of his Lord the Most High, and he will be well pleased.
So it's strong language, but so very clear. So very clear that the one who is mindful of God, who shares his wealth, his way shall be smooth towards hardship. But if you are self-satisfied, if you hoard that wealth will not help you as you fall. So we've heard it spoken, but now I invite you to sit back and hear it recited. This recitation is from Ahmad Saud, who I believe is about 10 years old. And I invite you to just let it wash over you and flow through you and imagine how this recitation can serve as a connection to your values, to your community, and to your commitments.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. والليل إذا يغشى والنهار إذا تجلى وما خلق الذكر والأنثى إن سعيكم لشتى فأما من أعطى واتقى وصدق بالحسنى فسنيسره لليسرى وَأَمَّا مَنْ بَخِلَ وَاسْتَغْنَى وَكَذَّبَ بِالْحُسْنَى فَسَنُيَسِّرُهُ لِلْعُسْرَى وَمَا يُغْنِي عَنْهُ مَالُهُ إِذَا تَرَدَّى إِنَّ عَلَيْنَا لَلْهُدَى وَإِنَّ لَنَا لَلْآخِرَةَ وَالْأُولَى فأنذرتكم نارا تلظى لا يصلاها إلا الأشقى الذي كذب وتولى وسيجنبها الأتقى الذي يؤتي ماله يتزكى وما لأحد عنده من تجزى إلا ابتغاء وجه ربه الأعلى ولسوف يرضى.
I don't know about you, but that does something to me and with me that words simply cannot. I feel this deeper sense of connection, this deeper sense of transcendence. And I wonder, is this something that we could do in Unitarian Universalism. Consider this. The hymn sung most widely in Unitarian Universalist congregations, most sing it every Sunday as we do, Spirit of Life, was written by its author, Carolyn McDade, explicitly as a prayer. It came after a long day of challenging justice work, and she was feeling an acute need for reassurance and for a reaffirmation of our values. I love the phrase Spirit of Life, and can think of no better way to summarize the transcendence that is at the heart of Unitarian Universalism. Spirit of Life, come unto me. Sing in my heart all the stirrings of compassion. Blow in the wind, rise in the sea, move in the hand, giving life the shape of justice. Roots hold me close, wings set me free. Spirit of Life, come to me, come to me. We sing it together in church as a shared prayer, but there's no reason we can't sing it at any other time of the day or week as well. The same is true of our closing hymn today, the Meditation on Breathing. Both are resources that we can use to remind us of our values and of our community at any time of the week. Sing it by yourself in the shower. Sing it by yourself in the car. Sing it on your commute. Sing it with your family. Sing it whenever you need it. The same goes with lighting a chalice, or at least a candle. I wonder how many of you have some sort of chalice at home? Just a few. Well, let me invite those of you who didn't raise your hand to consider getting one. Put it at a special place in your home, or put it right in the middle of your kitchen table or dining room table, and light it regularly. Light it when there's a particular joy that you want to celebrate, or a particular sorrow that you just need to be with. It's such a simple, and at least for me, meaningful way to acknowledge that something has happened. Whether or not we can do anything about it, we are aware and alive and connected. One spiritual practice that works very well for Mandy and I is toasting before meals. Anytime we're eating together and often with friends, too, we take a moment to toast, to appreciate being together, to appreciate being the food. No, to appreciate having the food. Sometimes it's about appreciating friends, old and new. Sometimes it's silent. You just take a few moments of quiet and then toast silently. When we're out having a drink together, we toast. When we have ice cream, we toast with it. And one of our favorite things to do at breakfast is to pick up our toast and toast to toast. Now, it may be tempting to think that some of these religious acts or spiritual practices may be kind of new for Unitarian Universalists. Actually, Reverend Rob Hardy is the senior minister at All Souls in D.C., recently did his doctoral dissertation on 18th century Unitarian spiritual practices, including prayer and journaling and meditation, practices that were incredibly widespread among Unitarians of that day. So what I'm advocating for us with spiritual practices is not something new. It's something old. I believe that our God, our Spirit of Life, is also a moral imperative. It's an imperative to economic justice, certainly, but also to racial justice and reproductive justice and environmental justice. It's a commitment to affirming and promoting the inherent worth and dignity of every single person on this planet. It's a commitment to values that are worth living and worth being reminded of. So let us pray with purpose, that we may act on that purpose as well. Amen.